Good evening. I'm Kim Irwin, and I'm manager of Live from the NYPL, and thank you so much for coming tonight. I know you love Live, and you love the New York Public Library, so tonight I'm asking you to show your support and join us to keep your library open. And that's by taking just a few minutes to write a letter to a city council member or a borough president. Record numbers of New Yorkers are relying on our libraries as a resource for job searches, and as you probably know by now, Barack Obama got his Chicago job through the New York Public Library. And we also face $57 million in budget cuts. So in the packet on your seats, you will find letter writing materials. The information includes names of representatives, samples of language for your letter, white paper, and an envelope. And if you've come to the library in the last few days, I'm sure you've seen the table set up right outside the bookshop. All New Yorkers have been writing letters every day. And in your letter, please ask your representative to restore the funding for the New York Public Library and explain why the library is important to you. You can write the address on the envelope or simply put your letter in the envelope, making sure that who you've addressed it to is in the letter, and we will have a volunteer address it for you. Letters will be collected at the end of the night as you go out the door, or you can put them in the box on the table as you go out the door. So again, thank you for supporting the New York Public Library. Now, some upcoming live events: Adam Gopnik, Steven Pinker this month, New Eyes on the Arab World, Breaking Down Barriers of Fear and Prejudice with five Arab and American writers such as Peter Thoreau and Mohamed Al-Mur and Alain de Botton, with a very interesting program on the pleasures and sorrows of work. And then in June, from June 9th through the 11th, Live will be participating in the Muslim Voices Arts and Ideas Festival, which is part of a 10-day festival presented by the Asia Society, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and the New York University Center for Dialogues. The festival will feature over 100 artists and speakers from Asia, Africa, Europe, and the Middle East, who will present diverse perspectives of the Muslim world. So stay tuned, go to our website, and find out about these five exciting events in June. And then I want to thank our bookseller, as always, 192 Books. Barbara Eisenberg and Alex Ross will be signing their books after the program, and you can pick up signed copies, purchased signed copies, pre-signed copies by Frank Gehry at the table right over there. And also, on your way out, you can also become a friend of Live, a friend of the library. And as you probably know by now, you can reduce your ticket price $10 and pay no service fee. So it's a really good deal for as little as $40 a year. And finally, we're going to have Q&A tonight, and I believe you have cards on your seats. And if you don't have one, just ask your neighbor. And please write legibly your question, and then approximately 8:15, we will have Live staff picking up the cards with the questions that will then be incorporated into the discussion. And be sure to check out Live from the NYPL on Facebook, Flickr, and Twitter. And now to introduce our guests is the director of Live and the no longer virgin Twitterer, Paul Holdengraber.
So I lost my virginity, I guess. It's a pleasure to have you here tonight. I'm Paul Holdengraber. Indeed, I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library. It's a great, great pleasure to welcome Frank Gehry to the New York Public Library for this program, to welcome Barbara Eisenberg and Alex Ross. I know them all from my blessed days in Santa Monica in Los Angeles. I always say that 1 year in New York is like 7 years in Los Angeles. I've never aged as much. But still, it's a great pleasure to be here and a great pleasure to have them tonight. I must start with some fairly sad news, but we will make the evening work beautifully. Esa-Pekka Salonen hurt his back, too much conducting, I suppose, and he is unable to come tonight. It's a great sadness for me because there's very, very few conductors in the world and composers in the world today that I admire as much as Esa-Pekka Salonen. Nevertheless, I will be a stand-in for him. I have perfected my Finnish accent, and I will try to do as well as I possibly can. To explain who Esa-Pekka Salonen is, I'd like to read a very short passage from Edgar Keret's book, The Girl on the Fridge. This will explain to you, I think, the kind of absolute precision that Esa-Pekka Salonen has when he speaks, a precision I really pine for. This is called asthma attack. When you have an asthma attack, you can't breathe. When you can't breathe, you can hardly talk. To make a sentence, all you get is the air in your lungs, which isn't much. 3 to 6 words, if that. You learn the value of words. You rummage through the jumble in your head. Choose the crucial ones. Those cost you too. Let healthy people toss out whatever comes in mind, the way you throw out the garbage. When an asthmatic says, I love you, and when an asthmatic says, I love you madly, there's a difference. The difference of a word's a lot. It could be stop or inhaler. It could even be ambulance. Esa-Pekka uses his words with extreme precision. I am here tonight to help the conversation, to help goad in some discreet way Alex Ross, to have him unravel for us his experience of knowing the work of Esa-Pekka Salonen for about 15 years and for having interviewed him many times. I'm here also to make sure that the conversation moves nicely along between Barbara Eisenberg, who has written a spectacular book of interviews with Esa-Pekka, with Frank Gehry, and it is a great pleasure to bring them now to the stage. Alex Ross, Barbara Eisenberg, and Frank Gehry. Barbara, start us off.
Okay. Talk among yourselves for one more second. I wanted to start with this morning in the New York Times, there was an advertisement for UCLA, which featured Eli Broad speaking about the great value of UCLA and Los Angeles as a great place for artists. And it struck me as just the perfect way to start an evening in which we're talking about artists who live and work in Los Angeles. So if it's a wonderful place for artists, it's obviously a wonderful place for composers and architects. So what I'd like to do is start with our architect and ask, you were raised in Toronto, you came to Los Angeles when you were 17 years old. I'd like to start with what you found there, and then we'll sort of come forward a little.
Scared the hell out of me. well, it wasn't great times that I got to, because my father had lost everything, which wasn't that much, but he did. He lost it. And so we both became truck drivers. He worked for a soda pop company and I worked for a furniture company. But LA was a lot rawer. I remember parts of Sunset Boulevard where it's 1947. We're still dirt roads, dirt, not paved. And I can't remember which streets were. I vaguely remember that the end of Wilshire Boulevard wasn't that finished a place.
And what about the light? You're always talking about the light.
Well, the light was startling. It was very different. It was soft and clear, and but you know, I was having a rough time, so I didn't. I only got into the light later.
Okay, let's zip ahead then. Let's zip ahead to when you're starting out as an architect then. And sort of Los Angeles at that time, when you were starting out, was a great place. There was a lot of freedom. Can you talk about kind of the carnival-like atmosphere and how Los Angeles struck you when you first got there?
Well, the construction of what they called dingbat houses was like a carpet going across the land. And everywhere you went, there were wood studs, and they're putting up these homes, which I finally realized looked better before they finished them. And that influenced me. That had a big... I still resonate to that kind of stuff. And in fact, the Serpentine Gallery we did in London last few months ago comes from some of that. There was a lot of freedom because nobody on the East Coast cared much about the architects on the West Coast. And we didn't have all the inter-architect, you know, sibling rivalry, because everybody's so spread out that you never saw anybody. The architecture school had the art school and ceramics. In fact, that's how I got into architecture, from ceramics, because the ceramics teacher, I think he paid for my first class, but I'm not sure. But I couldn't afford it, so he must have.
Then began your lifetime kind of affection for artists, didn't it? Affection, respect for...
Yeah, I was already loved art at that before that. But there was an art school. There were people painting. There were people making sculptures. They were doing... They had classes where they had the nudes standing there, and I went into those a few times. But some great old guys, Francis Dearley and Keith Crown, I don't know if these names are known, but Glenn Lukens was my ceramics teacher. And my ceramics, the work I did was terrible, so that's why he said, get out of here, go over there.
Well, tell about when Glenn Lukens was building a house with Rafael Soriano.
Yeah.
And you were still not sure kind of where you were going, and you went to visit that house and saw the great architect, Rafael Soriano, in action. What do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So Rafael Soriano was from the Isle of Rhodes. He had a broken nose. He wore all black, like I am, although this is blue, I think. And he had an orange tie and a little beret. And he was building a steel frame house. He was very Mesian architect. He was very purist. And he used to play Bach and said that that's what his influence was. And so I'd heard him talk and I'd seen some of his work. But I went to the site and this guy's there with this little beret and that people are erecting steel. And he's telling, you know, move that over there and move that over there and move that. And I my eyes must have lit up, because Glenn called me into his office the next day and said, you got to go there.
there being architecture school. Yeah. Well, maybe we should go back to your grandmother then.
Oh my God.
Let's go to your grandmother for a second. Because when you were a child in Toronto, and your grandmother, should I lead you in or do you want to?
No, she.
Okay.
My grandmother, I had been told, they left Poland in 1913 from the town of Lodz, Łódź, they call it. And she was as I was told, now this is folklore probably, she ran her family, had a foundry, and she was a foreman. And it was believable. I mean, she was a tough babe. And my grandfather had a hardware store, and she had a wood stove, and that's how they cooked on the wood stove. And she'd get wood shavings from the cabinet shop where they were making moldings and stuff. So they had a lot of scraps that were very interesting looking. I mean, they weren't just little blocks. They were curves and things. And she would bring them home, and before she used them, she'd spill them on the floor with me and start playing. And we made cities, like freeways, and before, you know, there was... I mean, I didn't know what I was doing, but I always remembered that it was after I remembered that as a license to play when you're an adult. And my good friend Milton Wexler talked about that a lot in the time I spent with him, that creative play or play when you're a kid is a preamble to work. And the spirit of creative play is valuable and a valuable thing to do, to think about. And I think, you know, you go to meetings with business people and high-powered financiers, and you often hear them say, well, why don't we come in Saturday and play around with this idea. So people think that way. I think not just artists, but everybody. And the freer you are, and the people who are successful, I think the more likely they are to be relevant or come up with things that are relevant to the moment, because they're a response to the moment instead of pre-manufactured kind of ideas, that there is a kind of a free association that pays off because it's immediate. And if you trust it, I think it's incredible.
Well, there was a segment of The Simpsons, which was about Frank Gehry, which actually addressed this point, where he received, in this particular segment, he received an invitation from the elders of Springfield.
From Marge.
Marge Simpson. Asking him to come in and design a building. And in the segment, he looks at the letter, he goes, ugh! Crumbles it up, throws it in the trash, does a double take, and says, wait a minute, pulls it out of the trash and looks at it and says, this is pretty good, right?
No, I said, Frank Gehry, you're a genius. and Judy Kavner, I think her name is, Marge,
yeah.
Trained me for 10 minutes how to say that.
You were great. You said it perfectly.
It was a line they gave me. I didn't. But it dogs me now. People say that all the time, like crumple up a piece of, you know. And that's how everybody thinks I design now.
But you know,
I was wondering if that sense of play that Frank Gehry was talking about, you find it in Esa-Pekka Salonen as well.
No, I think so. I mean, well, I wanted to jump in with a question about to what extent were you aware of this amazing world of the European emigres in Los Angeles when you said you were arriving at the tail end of this golden age, you know, as a music person, I think of the fact
like
that Schoenberg and Stravinsky. Was that, I mean, was this, were you conscious of these
Thomas
presences?
Thomas Mann was
yeah,
there.
Yeah, and did they sort of shape your sense of the Los Angeles landscape?
Well, the artist Wally Berman was in constant contact with Thomas Mann. There was a lot of talk about it. I never met him. I used to go to Stravinsky things at UCLA. I think I was at one of the last concerts he conducted with Robert Kraft, is that the name? I was aware of it.
Yeah,
I don't know what else to say. I went to concerts at UCLA and
yeah. It was when Esa Pekka Salonen came to Los Angeles. I mean, he was very much, of course, conscious of
that.
These relationships. There was even a moment where Stravinsky's old house was up for sale,
and he didn't want to live there.
And he thought of buying it, and then he was walking.
No, I had the same thing with Charles Eames' office. I almost moved in.
And why didn't you?
I couldn't.
You know, Esa Pekka said he'd walked into one room, and there were impressions on the carpet, and this is where Stravinsky's piano was, and he found that rather eerie, as if Stravinsky was lurking in the house. So he didn't do it, but. Yeah, I mean, I think this is a story of so many people arriving from faraway places in Los Angeles, and there is a remarkable transformation that can happen, as well as discovering these legacies of transplanted legacies of Europe.
I delivered Max Steiner's breakfast nook.
Really? the great film composer, of course, Max Steiner.
What did he have for breakfast?
I don't know.
Wait, and you created a breakfast nook for Roy Rogers and Dale Evans.
Oh, yeah, I know. That's an old story. I've never told this one before.
Ah.
This is a new one. I saved it for tonight. I think in my experience with Esa Pekka, he goes through the same agony that I go through, but he has to, when he faces his composition periods, he has to face it alone. At least I have a bunch of kids to play with,
right,
that I can, but both of us avoid it. We're in great denial, very similar. He does all kinds of things. Even I suspect he threw his back out. Not quite, but. I think circling the field because you're afraid of it. It's such an unknown thing. You're going to your territory that you're exploring.
How do you do that? How do you circle the field?
I call people on the phone. I make up things I have to do in the office to clean up. I'm very tidy. Megan is here. She can test it. I tidy up constantly. I move things, and my office doesn't look tidy. It's very, it's not like Richard Meyer's office where everything is. I'm a little bit messier, but I do that. It's a denial thing, I guess.
Right. Could you talk a little bit about your experiences early on with music, sort of leading into the question of Disney Hall and how this came into being, just your experiences as a concert goer and with concert halls, and what satisfied you and what didn't satisfy you, and what gap you wanted Disney Hall to fill.
Well, when I was a kid, my mother played the violin, and she used to take me to Massey Hall in Toronto. And I remember the conductor, Sir Ernest McMillan. Remember him? Was a composer, yeah. And he used to ride his bicycle in the park, which I saw on the way to school, and so I used to see him, and he was a very friendly guy. But I think that was important, that it was kind of accessible. He made it accessible to somebody my age. My mother took me there. I can't remember. Jan Kapura, is that name? He's a tenor. Mm-hmm. Boy, I'm dragging it out. and she also got me into, took me to art galleries as well. When I was in college at USC, I had a close friend, he's still a close friend, Greg Walsh, who was a pianist, wasn't a concert pianist, but he can play, he's a very accomplished pianist. And he had a great teacher in Pasadena. And Mary Lehigh. Why do I remember names just like that? I wouldn't remember it in a million years. And he talked often about her, and we would work together on projects, like, you know, separately, but as company. And we'd talk about, he loved music, and he, in fact, he took me to hear Rosalind Turek play the Goldberg Variations. And you know, my name was Goldberg when I was a kid. And now I've changed it to the Gary Variations.
Great, that's catching on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Slowly.
So, but he was instrumental in just keeping it in my space constantly. And we'd go to concerts. And, you know, it was mostly it never got into the new stuff. It was always kind of Mozart and Bach and Haydn, and I don't really remember him getting me into Mahler. Although we did, because Stravinsky was in town and because Schoenberg was in town, we did get into some of that.
Can you talk about what happens when you're sitting in a concert hall? Kind of what the music does for you, and
well, it depends. I mean,
what concert hall?
what concert hall? No, I fantasize. You know, I design. I fantasize. I mean, it's a more of an inspirational thing, but I pick up the structure, which I can hear the coda and the repeats and all that. I'm aware of that. And as I've gotten older, I'm aware of the influence of certain composers on other people. I mean, I can now see Esa-Pekka's, some of his influences from Sibelius, right? It's which I think is, is it more recent that he's?
Well, I think what he would say is that as a young man in Finland, you know, Sibelius was this absolutely towering presence, you know, national symbol, the most famous Finn who had ever lived. And so as an avant-garde youth, he sort of ran as far as he could in the opposite direction, but has slowly come to terms with Sibelius and sort of understood the radical as well as the conservative aspects, which I think is, I mean, isn't that an interesting question about this whole question in the 20th century? I think same debates happen in architecture as in music. Who is modern? Who is conservative? And sort of which side are you on? And I think somehow with your work and with...
But it's become more interesting in music.
Yeah.
Recently, in the last 10 years, maybe, than it
well,
was.
I think a lot of people have sort of just moved beyond.
No, but it's more exciting. I don't know.
I wonder if a musician would say it's more interesting in architecture.
Probably. There's always envy.
I don't know. Maybe.
I mean, it's in contemporary art as well. You know, that one of the things that...
But this seems more of an awakening than...
than
it seems like we went through that.
Well, this, I think, a synthesis of the sort of all the radical sounds, all the radical ideas that were put forward with the tradition, I think, especially the romantic element of 19th century music being folded together with these more radical sounds. But I think, I mean, when I go to Disney Hall, I mean, it's a romantic place. It fits with Beethoven and Mahler.
I always think of it as about
Mahler,
18th, 19th century.
As well as, you know, it's very apt for Stravinsky and Boulez and John Adams and the most modern music. And I think so, there's sort of a double-sidedness there in terms of the question of,
you know. Did you try to create a romantic space?
No. No, I tried to create, I mean, we should talk about Ernest Fleischmann too in a minute. Okay, don't forget. Because he was my real mentor in classical music. And he was the director of the LA Phil when we started Disney Hall. And I'd worked with him for 25 years at the Hollywood Bowl. So I knew the terrain. I knew that the orchestra had to hear each other. I knew that was an important thing. Sound, you know, because the Hollywood Bowl, they could not. And one of the things we did with those tubes and balls and things was to neutralize the effect of the rainbow shape so they could hear each other. So I knew that was important. And I knew from theater or even giving a talk like this that the relationship between the person talking and the audience is really important, and these lights are terrible in your face because they break that. But and I knew that if they heard each other, they played better. And Yasu Toyoda, our acoustician, said that if it would take a couple years for the orchestra to find its sound, and I think he was pretty close to accurate that they started to understand each other and play better. And then the thing was to make a room that the people that were listening felt a relationship with the orchestra. And the orchestra felt a relationship with the people. So that music better, they respond because better. When they respond, they feel it. They play better. Da, 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 da. So it's that simple. So you make a room that, as best you can, creates a sense of intimacy. And so one of the things that a lot of the former patrons of the orchestra were mad about is I took out all continental seating. The continental seating would have made the space bigger, and by taking it out, we created more intimacy and that pays off a lot in the feeling of the.
Yeah, what I feel as I. What I first feel when I walk in is a slightly negative feeling, which is a gnawing envy that I have to go all the way to LA and can't go to Lincoln Center or someone else, so somewhere else close by to have this experience.
I'd be happy to come and do one here.
But it's, yeah, and then what Ernest Fleischmann, the sort of revolution that Ernest Fleischmann started when he was running the LA Philharmonic was, you know, we have this great tradition, let's not abandon it. You know, we remain absolutely in touch with the great tradition, but try to create an orchestra and a space that is also very hospitable to the newest sounds, and to create a sort of a continuity from the past to the present. And also, yeah, in terms of the question of intimacy, bringing the audience closer to the music. Don't put it up on this sort of pedestal with the proscenium and so on. And yet to preserve a somewhat mystical atmosphere, right. You know, not to make it plain and sort of, you know, nothing vulgar about it. So, which is all these things are what as Pekka Salonen would say as well. I think about the place that he wants classical music to have in the society, to be sort of in the midst of things, not up on the pedestal, and yet to retain its special aura and all those things. Well, somehow, amazingly, this hall does, and it sounds great and it looks beautiful. And
well, it's you know, the orchestra is made up of rugged individualists, right? Some of them have garlic with their food, and some of them do funny things. They are funny, right? Yeah. They each, you know, and they, and some of them have figured out how to play footsie with the stagehands so they get their seat moved. And over time, that the organization of the orchestra on stage disintegrates into a kind of a messy thing. And I picked up on the messiness, and I hadn't seen that in other orchestras, and I asked Esa-Pekka about it. And he said, yes, we have to do something about it. And so Ernest got us Royce Hall for a day. We moved the orchestra over there. And Esa-Pekka was also teaching me how he can change the room, the acoustic, by how he conducts. So there's obvious musician can do that, right? I mean, Gergiev came into L.A., Phil, first concert, no rehearsal, in playing the Shostakovich, he nailed it. So the intuition, and it's obvious that they would have that. So we moved the orchestra around at Royce, and then we measured it and built risers in the Chandler exactly like that. And the orchestra went and sat on it. And Martin Bernheimer, the former critic, who never gave the L.A. Phil anything nice, said, I don't know what happened, but it sounded so much better. And it was, you know, it was obvious. They were playing tight, and it worked. Within the next few weeks, they started stuff. But we watched it and monitored it. And some of them were, you know, they were legitimate. They were going to fall off the edge and stuff. And we modified it a couple times. And then that's what's in Disney Hall. So it was a lot of, but because Esa-Pekka is who he is, and because Ernest is who he is, and we had a lot of freedom, free flow with the orchestra, with stagehands that were willing to play with us. And the normal fights between acoustician and architect didn't exist in this case. It was total wonderful. When I met Dr. Nagata, who was Toyota's boss or mentor, it was with Ernest in Berlin at the Kempinski, and we met with Lothar Kramer, who was von Karajan's acoustician and who's the architect? Charoon was the architect. And
Who designed the Philharmonie?
The Philharmonie was at that point kind of the best example, and we went there a lot. I went there a lot.
Did you go there to learn?
Yeah, I went there to learn about the people thing, because every time I went, I met people easily. If I went alone, I mean, not picking up. I mean, it was just.
I understand.
It was funny, and I never experienced it. And it has industrial pipe columns, handrails, concrete floor, all the things that the L.A. guys thought I was going to do to L.A. and they didn't want me to do. But there was a thing that Charoon had about people that hall had. And the library across the road by Charoon, I went to it. It also had that feeling. And the chamber hall, which was built after Charoon's death, didn't have it. Same design, you know, same language, but it doesn't have
sort of creating.
It doesn't have the feeling. So there's something in that that I knew, and you know, it's not something you can quantify. You just kind of hope you can do it. The meeting with Kramer, he said the hall should be like that with the orchestra, the wider part. And Toyota said the hall should be like that with the orchestra at the narrow part. And each one told me how great they respected the other one. And I said, well, what do I do with that information now? And they got into the biggest fight over it. I mean, the Japanese guy won because he was so polite. But I think it's a feeling thing, and I think Ernest understood it, Esapekka understood it, and Toyota understood it, and there are wonderful tapes that nobody's seen of that the Getty made, and someday they should see the light of day, I hope. Where every time a musician came to LA to play with the Philharmonic, I hijacked them to the office. And so we had a 1-10 model where you could go into it. And we put Pierre Boulez in there one day. And I brought him a sandwich for lunch, and he was still in there. And he came out and said, it's going to work. No problem. And Simon Rattle, same, and I forget the guy from
Zubin Mehta.
Zubin.
And you built a model. When he was building all the models, he also built a model of Esa-Pekka's hall in Sweden, so that Esa-Pekka could look at the two models, the model of Disney Hall, and compare it in size.
Yeah, so he could understand the language. Right, I did do that. Yeah. He was great to work with, this kid. I mean, I met him when he was 23. Right?
And he still is a kid in some way. He's still cool. I wonder, Alex, how does Esa-Pekka Salonen maintain his cool? I mean, how does he remain so cool?
It's Finland.
You think it's Finland? Everybody in Finland is cool?
He said recently, somewhere, I don't know if you were there when he said it, he said, when you praise a Finn, he looks at his shoes. And if he's an egomaniac Finn, he looks at your shoes.
Yeah. Well, I think unusual among conductors, and I think the thing about him is he wasn't sort of born to be a conductor. He didn't dream of being a conductor. He really did sort of blunder into it and sort of showed a knack for it before he really intended to make a career of it. But there is that that self-effacing quality, just sort of not taking this whole maestro business too seriously, you know, dedicating oneself to the music and to his own work and not sort of participating in this sort of grandiose fantasy of sort of, you know, elevating yourself. And I think that's very important, as well as I think, you know, but there's also, I mean, there's a real determination there to, you know, at a certain point it would have been so easy for him to just continue going along with his international conducting career and sort of let the composition fall by the wayside. And I think in the last 10 years, his determination to put that back front and center and to carve out the time, very difficult to do amid all his other commitments, to write these big pieces, piano concerto, violin concerto, and wing on wing. And I think
I'd love you to play, but even just a second before you play it, I read a piece of yours that you wrote in 1994 about Esa-Pekka Salonen, and in a way, then he was already so clear about what his vision, mission was.
Right, to shift the repertory more toward the 20th century without abandoning the tradition, to put classical music back into the general cultural conversation. You know, people know modern art. They go to galleries. They know the great architects of the modern era. They go to art films, and sort of classical music is just sort of missing from that menu for a lot of educated people. And he was saying we can bring it back, and we can do it by emphasizing precisely what so many people are scared of, the 20th century and contemporary work, but by choosing and curating the programs very carefully, we can show how Beethoven relates to Mahler and how Stravinsky relates to Ligeti, and to bring it all together. So this piece, Wing on Wing, was written for the first season of Disney Hall, and it is a piece that is written very much with the acoustics of the space in mind, as well as the shapes, the flowing contours of the space. And as if that's not enough to relate it to the subject matter, I think you will hear a familiar voice in the passage. We'll hear a tape that he incorporated and electronically modified to some extent, weaving it into the orchestral fabric.
This is really embarrassing for me.
Reaction when you discovered that it's a Pekka.
It didn't have the part where I said why the fish.
I think that was right at the beginning.
It was?
Why the fish? Yeah. Right.
Well, he hijacked me for this. He said he needed my voice, and that nobody would recognize me, and it would scramble it. So they, and so I went to a sound studio with him, and we talked, and. Then I went to the concert. There were two color tours. You didn't hear the whole thing. And at one point, I say very loudly, that more loudly, he must have cut it out of the recording, because at the first concert, I'm sitting there thinking, isn't this fun to be in a piece, you know? And I hear little snippets of my voice, which, fine, nobody, I didn't care about that. Then all of a sudden I hear, why the fish? I wanted to crawl under the...
What was that, what were you saying? What were you saying about...
I don't know, he asked me why I was working with fish shapes and things. Why the fish? And so when the orchestra plays that in rehearsal, when that comes on, they say, Because there's no beef. And when they play it in concert, they mouth it. So
again,
somehow
you got rid of
the part that was embarrassing.
Barbara, how did you come about writing this book, and what was it like over these years interviewing Frank Gehry?
I think this evening is fairly difficult. I actually was at Disney Hall. This was in December '04, and I was there for the Tristan and Isolde that Esa-Pekka Salonen was conducting. And at the intermission, Frank Gehry said, could you give me a call? I have a little something I want to discuss with you. So I said, yes. And then I called him the next day, and I went to see him. And he, at that time, was 75 years old. May I give your age away? He is now 80 years old, and he was thinking about his legacy. He wanted to do an oral history. And at that point, I had interviewed him for years. I followed the progress on Disney Hall for the LA Times. I'd written about the building at MIT for Esquire. He was a major figure in my last book. And I thought, I'd love to do this. I love interviewing him. And then as we progressed with our interviews, they sort of took on a life of their own and became this book.
A life of their own, can you...
Meaning, they were sort of like an oral history to begin with. But we would meet at his office, I would say, sometimes it'd be like every week, sometimes it'd be 3 months in between. And he has a studio in the Gehry Partners office. And in that studio is a large conference table, which is filled with whatever is on his mind at that given moment. And it could be a model that he's working on. It could be... the first time I went in, he had the prototype of his new cloud lamp. Do you remember this? Probably not. Okay. And there'd be photographs of a building under construction. And then there would be always paper and pencil. Because as we started to talk, his memory is a visual memory, and he would start to remember something. Am I right? I'll keep going.
I don't remember.
But
I remember the story all different, but I'll tell my side.
Okay, we'll each tell it our own way. But he would start to talk about like an experience from his childhood or about the neighborhood in Toronto where he grew up, and he'd kind of say, well, wait a minute, and then he'd take paper and pencil and start drawing it for me. And at some point I said, we can't do this. This is prose. We need to put this into prose, into words. And the other thing about our process is that I would come in all prepared to talk about Bilbao or Disney Hall or the building, the Wiseman Gallery or inspiration or whatever, and I'd walk in, and that was not what he wanted to talk about that day. So it was a constant kind of reshaping of a conversation.
So here's how I remember it.
Uh-oh.
Ernest Fleischman, the guy we talked about, had an oral history done at UCLA, and he started bugging me that I should have that done. And then Milton Wexler, my friend, said, do you ever write down these stories, that what happens in your life? And I said, no. And he said, you should, just for someday, over the rainbow. And then I had another friend who urged me to have an oral history in case there was a chance in the future to write a biography. And he thought of that I should do that. I went to the UCLA thing, met them, and it was too toxic for me. The way they set it up, I wasn't going to be able to do that, what they wanted to do. And I was at a funeral, and I was sitting next to Barbara. I don't remember whose funeral.
Do you remember?
No.
Yeah.
knew a lot, or we actually know a lot of the same people. So, in that case, we knew that particular person who is no longer with us.
But it was a big funeral. There were a lot of people there. And I started talking to her at intermission. and said, do you know how I could get an oral history done that would be not toxic? And she said, I'll do it. That's why I remember.
I like his story. Let's make that the official story.
Yeah, it's probably a little of each.
It's good.
But I knew her really well and felt comfortable with her persona and the way she writes, the way she thinks. Her breadth beyond architecture and is in all the arts, and so it was comfortable for me to talk to her. I had no idea we were going to do this, but I was shocked when we started doing it. But I'm happy we did. I'm
good.
Happy for Barbara that we did it. I don't know. I don't want to sign them all. No, it's interesting to ruminate, rummage through some of those days. When I was in the Army, there was a music connection too. Henry Lewis was in my company. Henry in basic training. Hmm? Henry Lewis, who married Marilyn Horne.
Oh yeah,
right. And he conducted the Army Symphony Orchestra. Mm-hmm. It was 1955. Wow.
Spend a fair amount of time talking in your book also about the whole notion of process and Frank's process with the work. I think that's...
The process and the inspiration,
right.
Which is sort of what I was touching on a little bit with the Simpson story, because one of the things that I find most exciting now, which I found most exciting all these years, is how everything can be inspiration. The cover of the book is a picture of a building in Dusseldorf. It's a three-part building. This particular building complex in Dusseldorf had the influence of two things. Do you remember? It was the Giorgio Morani bottle villages and a picture of Madonna and Child with saints. Those were among the many influences for this particular... these are sketches. He sketches. But why don't you talk about sort of the notion of how you sketch and then it becomes a model and then how you sketch again? And
well, since that people have been publishing my sketches, I stopped sketching. I've become self-conscious.
No, that's not true. Because at one point when we were talking, so I can correct you, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So at one point we were chatting and I said, well, how long does it take to do a sketch? So Frank Gehry looks at his wristwatch and goes, okay. And then he sketches and he goes, 15 seconds.
Well, it's free association. It's hand-eye coordination. I think it's crucial to be able to do that, and the computer coming in now is wrecking it a little bit for the younger kids in architecture school. They're not drawing as much. They're losing some of that. I think some of the schools are aware of it now and are creating drawing programs because it's immediate hand-eye coordination. You're thinking. It's a shorthand. It looks like a scribble to me when it's done. So it really looks like a scribble to everybody else. But then when the building gets built, you can recognize it.
Well, an example would be the interactive court building in Chelsea, across from the Chelsea Pier. When I interviewed Barry Diller about that building and the original sketch, and he said that the original sketch was almost exactly the building that was built. Now, I know there was a lot of anguish in between that, you know, the sketch and the building, but there are various sketches. I think that's what's particularly interesting, is that there is a sketch that's sort of immediate, but then there are all those informed sketches. What are they informed by?
Well, I always think about them as like the slaves, you know, Michelangelo chipping away. He knows that thing's in there, and he's going to find it. And I think it's very similar. I know something's there, and I dig for it through these drawings. And some of them are like the first three or four drawings of the Bilbao building are very close to what got built. But I wasn't aware of it until after the building was built. So I didn't take that drawing and then say, build this. I started with models and ideas that came out of those drawings, and then I had to suffer. It's a Jewish thing that you have to suffer. And you go through this suffering, and then sometimes you go back. And often you continue, you know, but there is always a relationship. When you see the, you know, 100 drawings or so for every project, you can see the thread of the thinking. And I'll draw a bunch of stuff, then I'll talk to the kids to make models, and I'll sort of direct them. But I don't look and say, here, do this. I just put the drawing away, and the thoughts are in my head. And I start them down a path, and then when I see the beginnings of the models, I go back. When I'm alone, I sketch again from the knowledge of that. And what I'm doing is trying to understand the program, the site, the budget, all those practical things. That so it's like a crystal. So it's, I keep it liquid as long as I can. So as I gather information and it starts to inform the project, and that changes. And you know, you're working on something for 6 months. And a lot of things change, a lot of things in every area of every facet of the building's life and its clients and its budgets and the people involved. And I try to respond to all of that as best I can. And so I keep that fluid for as long as I can. Frustrates people sometimes.
And then you start over.
And then I sometimes start over. But I usually stay within the normal gestation period that's normal to an architectural practice. But I can usually do it. Now I can do it a little quicker.
But. In your book, you ask Frank a question about libraries, and Frank, you say that libraries are very important for you, that they're a place of silence, a place of reflection. I wonder if you could say something about we're in one. And maybe you can say something even about this particular library.
No, I don't want to say anything about that.
Talk about your library, the library you built in Hollywood. Do you have a comment on that?
Oh, that was funny. It looks like a fortress, and because Hollywood was, when I was doing that, the Hillside Strangler had been found using that library.
Let's go back.
It's not a very good
New York. Not, seems like a nice, safe place here. Let's talk about this library and the silence. What about the silence of a library?
Well, there's not much refuge where you get complete silence, unless you go into an anechoic chamber somewhere. And the books tend to absorb all the ambient sound, so it's kind of anechoic. I don't know. I think any of it, it's like discovering things that you don't know about. You just start one place and, you know, like I was studying Nijinsky once when I was in college. I was fascinated with his dance and the music. And Diaghilev and that whole thing. I think because I met Mary Brand, who was an assistant, or had something to do with Diaghilev, and so it became very interesting. And I went to the library and I just started picking up books on Nijinsky, and then it leads you on a wild trail if you follow it. Of the existential thinking, which was around the time Camus wrote Étranger. So it's like discovery and picking up threads and information. I usually don't talk about this. This is kind of, I don't know how to talk about it. mean, it's not because it's overly private. It's just, you know, in late years now, my wife can read a book. She reads a couple of books a week and remembers every bloody thing in detail. And I don't. And so it's frustrating.
You don't read or you don't remember?
I read a lot, but I don't remember a lot. I read his book. That's how we got together.
You've interviewed Esa-Pekka Salonen now and written about him for the last 15, 17 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, now that he's leaving his post at the Los Angeles Philharmonic and going off to London, how you perceive his evolution from the early days when you wrote about him in the early 90s, maybe even before, and now. And where he found the orchestra when he arrived and where he's leaving it now,
right,
with
wow,
Disney Hall.
Fantastic.
Well, you've known him longer than I have.
It's a different orchestra.
Yeah, well, he refined the sound. I mean, what I say about the LA Philharmonic, you know, you can argue endlessly which orchestra belongs in the top 5 or the top 10 or the top 17, and which plays Brahms second better and which plays Brahms third better, and how do the horns compare and all this and that, all the technical level. And you know, by those standards, the LA Phil is an extremely good orchestra, you know, sort of in the top tier. But when you look beyond that to, is there a vision? What is the purpose of all this practice and sort of perfecting of details, sort of what's it all about, Alfie? And I think he created a sense of mission and a vision for that orchestra that made it the most interesting orchestra in America, maybe in the world. It made news year after year. You know, I had to go out there to see what was going on, festivals, premieres, Tristan and Isolde with Peter Sellers, multimedia projects, then the Disney Hall moment and the magnificent growth and transformation that happened there. So it's an incredible story. But I think your hall made that final leap possible.
You know,
sort of it's
sold out every night, that hall, and the seats are filled. I mean, it's amazing. So,
what is it due to? Do you have a perception what it's due to that the hall is so inhabited and sold out? Is there a reason for it?
That's what I said. They can feel each other. There's a response. I mean, I've had longtime concert goers who are Philharmonic patrons for years tell me that they used to buy the tickets and would only go to a third of the concerts. Since Esa-Pekka and the new hall, they come to all the concerts. So they're very little no-show stuff. Even in the so-called fancy seats where the board people or the people that are supporters They're usually filled. You don't find any empty.
What were your feelings at his final concert in April 19th?
I went to Stravinsky. It twice. So I was the second time I closed my eyes and listened to the music. The first time, Peter Sellers was a little startling for me, but I love what he does, so I'm not. It was just a bit overwhelming, but he moved the chorus around. They circled the orchestra for the songs, I think, and it created a sound in the hall that I hadn't heard. It was amazing, bloody amazing. The emotion, everybody, all of us felt very emotional about Esa Pekka's leaving, and as we do, and it's I wish he was here, and I'm going to miss him a lot, except he promised to come back and see us from time to time. The new guy I've met, and it's going to be a new experience, right? A whole different Dudamel is young. He's conducted here, so people here know him. His repertoire is different. He's going to do a whole different thing. It's not the same. And he loves architecture, so that's good. He likes architecture, period. He follows it. And so he's outgoing, where Esa Pekka is like this. This guy is. He's a tsunami. It's a different kind of feeling. And so I think, you know, for LA to have a Latin conductor will do things that Ernest Fleischman tried to do from the beginning, is to bring that community which lives around the hall into the hall. And this might help do that. They've already started a program like the Sistema that he comes from in Venezuela. They've already started an incubator system like that in Los Angeles. So.
Oh, I was just remembering back to when Esa Pekka first came to Los Angeles, and I remember interviewing some of the members of the orchestra who were not entirely welcoming. I remember one violinist telling me, well, you know, I've been in this orchestra since before he was born. But if you contrast that with the way he left the orchestra, can you describe the way, your piece in The New Yorker about his final performance was like reliving it again. So can you just kind of sum up your prose just a little bit? I thought you really captured what Esa Pekka had captured during all those years at the Philharmonic.
Yeah, well, I think the really striking thing about that final concert was he could have very easily gone out with some enormous noise, a big Mahler or Beethoven's Ninth, something that would sort of train the spotlight on him. And instead, he created this fascinating evening in which the Peter Sellers production of these Stravinsky pieces was playing off of the architecture of the hall, and people were moving around. So it embraced everyone who had been involved in his career.
That's the essence of this guy, yeah.
You and the orchestra and everyone he had been working with, to the point where somewhere toward the end I had to remind myself that this was his final concert, and yeah. This was really about him. You were so
and he
swept
didn't even
up.
Want to take a bow by himself.
And so he kept dragging people on stage with him during the final bows, and finally there was rhythmic clapping from the audience, and he was forced to take his solo bow. And then this really emotional moment happened where the violinists and violists who had not played in Symphony of Psalms, which has only cellos and double basses for strings, for came back on stage, and some of the women were holding flowers, and that was when people really started breaking down in tears, and he was hugging each member of the orchestra. And the point is, in the classical music world, players are really not supposed to be particularly emotive on stage, and especially orchestral musicians, you keep cool, and particularly if it's a conductor, there's a certain distance there, one of respect and also of a bit of skepticism and so on toward that whole profession. And it was so different, and it was such a, it was so intimate that I almost felt, as someone from New York, I was intruding on a family affair.
Yeah, it felt like that.
I love that line where you say, Saarinen beamed, blushed, cried a little, and mouthed a phrase that looked like, let's go get a drink.
That's what he always did.
What, say, let's go and get a drink?
Yeah, I mean, he'd go in the dressing room after the concert, and that's...
Well, before we go and get a drink, a few questions, there are about 20 here, we'll have about two or three. A question for you, Frank, from a BBC radio reporter here tonight.
Oh, my God.
We can skip it, but I'll read it nevertheless. The Guggenheim Museum celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. Were you inspired by Frank Lloyd Wright's iconic design when you conceived your own Guggenheim building in Bilbao? Is there a unifying theme or spirit between their two structures and your next Guggenheim in Dubai?
Abu Dhabi.
Abu Dhabi, see? You got it wrong.
Not Dubai. Well, as a student, I studied Frank Lloyd Wright very closely. I visited as many buildings as I could. I loved his work. I didn't like his politics. I didn't, and so I never attended any of his lectures. And I went to Taliesin after leaving Harvard, driving back cross country. The wife and two kids, and the flag was up, and he was there. That meant. And they wanted a dollar for each of us to go in, and so I told them to shove it and left. I think the Guggenheim Museum was compromised. It wasn't completely as he wanted it. It was antithetical to contemporary art. He hated contemporary art. He was making tokonomas for Japanese Edo period screens. So there wasn't much to emulate except the bravura of it and that he couldn't have done it exactly the way he wanted. I think he did a parking garage like that as a predecessor to that building.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. Yeah. So
it didn't
influence the I don't think it influenced, but having said that, it did. I mean, Diane Waldman was curator there for 25 years. And she loved, and she never complained about. So it shows you can, there were some magnificent shows there over the years that worked. They made them work.
Brings me to the next question. At what point does the form of a building interfere with the art it houses? How is this different in a museum and a concert hall?
Well, it's the same issue, isn't it? It's the audience, it's the relationship between the audience and the artist, the work. And so there's a certain amount of comfort that has to happen. People have to, you shouldn't be punished to go look at a work of art.
Should only hurt slightly.
Well, sometimes. I think that when Bilbao was finished, I got that rap. The rap was, oh yeah, the building's terrific and toxic for art and doesn't matter. People are going to come anyway. And that infected a lot of artists. In fact, recently, Cy Twombly had a retrospective there. And he refused to have the show there for a long time. And Carmen Jimenez, one of the really, arguably, one of the best curators on the planet, convinced him to do it, and then he loved it and has raved about it, said it was one of the best places to show his work. And she's done many shows there and said that that was a bad rap. And other curators have said that too. So I think, Bob Rauschenberg, who hated architects, didn't like that. And I was friends for years, but I did a little gallery for Gemini, and he hated it, so he didn't talk to me for 10 years. And the day Bilbao was open, there he was in the atrium with a blue peacock coat, and I thought, I don't give a damn if you're here. I'm not going to let you ruin my day. And so I walked around trying to hide from him. And he caught me, and he grabbed me and kissed me. He actually kissed me on the lips. And loved it. So we rebuilt our friendship. But I haven't had much kickback. I mean, Jim Dine liked it, Helen Frankenthaler. I mean, these are people that would normally like the white cube and the sort of faceless thing. I think that the faceless thing, when carried too far, becomes a perfection pedestal that interferes with the vision, the seeing of art. And it is more intrusive in the end. And you see it in some shows.
Well, there's some kickback here. There are about 7 questions about this. I will boil it down to one. People want to know what more plans you might have for New York City, particularly in the context of a March comment you made about the Atlantic Yards, where you say, I don't think they will happen. And people want to know what you mean by that.
No, that was misread. I probably said something like that, but I'm always, you know, the glass is half full. It's going ahead. It is. There's work going ahead. Every developer in the world is struggling with the times we're in and reassessing everything. And a lot of that's going on all the development projects. All the developers I'm working with are doing the same thing. And so it's frustrating for somebody like me because, you know, we've been working on it 5 years and we've done all this work and it's ready to go. And then in Brooklyn, there's a lawsuit, one lawsuit that persists, and they can't start until that's settled.
Barbara, how did this book transform you?
Well...
Or did it?
I think I learned a lot about appreciating everything as inspiration. You know, I mean... I don't know, but it transformed me. I enjoyed it enormously. I mean, how many times in life do you have a chance to really, truly get to know the creative mind? And in fact, it's what intrigued me about the whole prospect of doing this book was I wanted to ask the question, how does art happen? Now, if you ask somebody, how does art happen? They're going to roll their eyes, as he would. But if you ask them for 4 years, over and over, in a million different ways, you are bound to get an answer.
You know, it always reminds me of that Leonard Cohen line. He said, if I knew where inspiration came from, I would go there more often.
Yeah. Well, I always say, if I knew where I was going to go ahead, I wouldn't go there. But the neuroscientists are now onto the whole thing of creativity. Have you been aware of that? They're getting into it. They're trying to get into the act.
How are they doing?
Spoil the phone.
So I gave a keynote address to the neuroscientists, 7,000 of them, a couple of years ago.
7,000 neuroscientists.
Including a lot of Nobel guys. And I didn't know what, I never prepare. I just got up and started talking. But the questions that they're asking are like, they want to know whether the effect of square or round shapes or things like that. And I keep saying, you know, get a life. That's not the issue. the real issue they should go is go out a little further into space and look back is, why do we do it? Why did Mahler do that stuff? And why do people love it? And how does it nurture us? And why do, and to understand the importance of it in our lives and what it does for our children and our world and our daily existence, that's the issue. Why? We need it. So why deny that? I think these efforts, whether it's circle or square, is a denial mechanism.
I think to find out much more about your own creativity, reading your conversations with Barbara Eisenberg.
I'll have to read it.
Well, no, you don't have to read it. You have to live it, right? Well, Barbara Eisenberg, Alex Ross, Frank Gehry, thank you very much. Thank you.